And now we return to Monday's conference at the Brookings Institution on the Trump administration's 2018 Nuclear Posture Review. Up next, a Q&A with Deputy Defense Undersecretary for Policy David Trachtenberg. That'll be followed by a panel discussion with nuclear security experts and former government officials. The Nuclear Posture Review is a periodic Defense Department report mandated by Congress, which describes the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. national security policy.
Questions? Comments? Suggestions? Recommendations? Yes, sir.
Thank you. If you are going to get involved in a low-yield weapon exchange, how do you figure you're going to prevent it from escalating to more conventional size nuclear weapons?
I don't think of it in terms of getting involved in an exchange at all. The way we look at this, again, is what we are trying to do is we are trying to prevent an exchange, not engage in one. And therefore, it's incumbent upon us to think about how do we do that in a world that has changed dramatically since the last NPR was done and reflects developments by Russia and other states that tend to suggest increased reliance on nuclear weapons and the possibility that nuclear weapons, even in a limited way, might have some degree of political or military utility. And so the recommendations that we're proposing to include a low-yield ballistic missile and a sea-launched nuclear-armed cruise missile are intended not to engage or not to fight a nuclear war or not to even suggest that one could be fought in a way that is limited, however one wants to define the term limited, but are designed to try to convince adversaries and potential opponents that they should not feel that they have some exploitable advantage by using a capability for which the United States has no counter. So the very purpose of what we're doing is war prevention, not war fighting. And I understand the characterizations, many of the characterizations that I have seen tend to suggest that what we are looking to do is engage in precisely the kind of limited strikes that your question suggests. I'd suggest looking at it differently. What we're trying to do is prevent an opponent from believing that such a course of action is actually useful or beneficial.
So you believe a small deterrent is more effective than a big deterrent? I'm talking about the size of nuclear weapons.
Or now, what
the explosive yield of nuclear weapons?
Sure. What we believe is having flexible nuclear capabilities tailored to specific circumstances makes the most sense for deterrence and for assurance. Obviously, no two states are alike. We have multiple threats that we are trying to deter, and to do that may take flexible capabilities. In some cases, certain types of military capabilities may be sufficient for deterrence. In other cases, opponents may see them as less sufficient. So what we are trying to do is ensure that there is a necessary flexibility and resilience and robustness in terms of the capabilities we have at our disposal in order to deter, dissuade opponents from believing they have any kind of military advantage that they believe they can use either to initiate conflict or escalate conflict. That is the entire purpose of the recommendations that you find in the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review. Sir.
Hi, thank you. I would like to know if you're concerned that enhancing nuclear capabilities can be seen as a contradiction to the commitment that you mentioned of non-proliferation agreements, and if it can also promote an arms race?
I would answer this way. First of all, I don't see it as a contradiction whatsoever. In fact, I mentioned our extended deterrent that we extend to over 24 plus allies overseas. I would argue that our nuclear arsenal, the arsenal that we have that serves that extended deterrent function, is quite possibly the most successful non-proliferation tool we've had in our toolkit, literally for decades, because it has dissuaded friends and allies from feeling the need to develop or acquire nuclear weapons of their own. So from a non-proliferation standpoint, the nuclear capabilities we have, I think, very much support U.S. non-proliferation objectives. In terms of the question about an arms race, I've seen that commentary as well a number of times. I go back to the statement that I read from former Secretary of Defense Ash Carter. If there's an arms race, the United States is not participating. In fact, the United States has not been participating for quite some time. If you look at the details of what the Russian Federation has been doing in terms of its own nuclear modernization program, if you look at Russian military doctrine, if you look at the exercises, the strategic force exercises that Russia has conducted, a number of which really have been unrivaled since the days of the Cold War, a number of which involve the exercise of their strategic nuclear forces and, in fact, the simulated use, first use, of nuclear weapons. If you look at all of the systems that the Russians have been engaged in modernizing in recent years, it's very difficult for me to understand how what we are proposing to do in this nuclear posture review, in terms of maintaining the efficacy of the existing triad and developing these two supplemental, I believe, very modest supplemental capabilities that I mentioned, in any way, shape, or form, heralds an arms race. We're not looking to match what Russia is doing weapon for weapon. We're not looking to do to build up the thousands of non-strategic nuclear weapons that the Russians have in their arsenal. Again, what we're trying to do is we're trying to convince potential adversaries, whether it be Russia, China, North Korea, whomever, that there is no benefit to them of pursuing a course of action which could lead, which might lead, to their actual use of nuclear weapons first or in some kind of so-called limited way. What we want to do is make absolutely certain that the cost to an opponent, to an aggressor, of any nuclear use far outweigh any perceived benefits that they might think would accrue to them. That is the essence of what we have recommended in this NPR. And again, I would argue it's relatively consistent with sort of the traditional U.S. nuclear policies as they have evolved over many decades. So again, I think there is much more continuity to this particular NPR and its conclusions and recommendations vis-a-vis prior NPRs than differences. There's a lot of continuity there, and that continuity is has been occasionally overlooked.
Thank you, sir. I come from a country that was under an extended nuclear deterrence relationship with the United States, New Zealand, but then decided that our security would be better if we were non-nuclear and not a nuclear target. So we withdrew from that nuclear deterrence relationship. Would you, and we're now signed the new treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. Would you be supportive of other of the allies of the United States deciding that for their national interests they would be more secure not to be in a nuclear alliance and also signing the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons?
Well, of course, it's up to individual states and individual allies to decide what approach they want to take. But I will tell you, we have had similar discussions and debates in the NATO context for many years. NATO remains a nuclear alliance. I don't see that changing in the near future. There is a general recognition among allies that nuclear deterrence remains important. I think there is also a general recognition that because of some of the changes that I alluded to that have taken place in the world environment in recent years, the issue of preventing nuclear conflict has taken on a growing importance. And the role of nuclear weapons in doing that is also generally recognized by allies. So I don't want to obviously speak for what other countries should or shouldn't do. But I think it's clear not only to the United States, but it's clear to U.S. allies abroad as well, many of whom share our threat perceptions and understanding of some of the dangers that we see posed by others, and share our recognition that it is critically important, perhaps more so now than ever before, to make sure we have the wherewithal and the capabilities and the resolve to ensure that potential adversaries do not miscalculate and do not believe they have some kind of advantage to that is exploitable, that they can take advantage of. So, I think that is in the sort of mainstream of U.S. nuclear tradition. I don't see anything odd or unusual about that. But again, whether we like nuclear weapons or we don't, we might all wish that we lived in a world without them. But we also have to recognize reality, and reality is nuclear weapons do exist. Some states have gone in a direction quite opposite the direction that the United States has gone in terms of the size of its nuclear arsenal and its attention its focus on nuclear weapons as part of its national security strategy. That's a disquieting development, in my view. And it's one that we need to be forthright in confronting, straightforward. Yes, sir.
I appreciate your presentation. Thank you for it. And I've learned a lot from it. But I wonder whether your approach may, in fact, run afoul of some of the very things that you warn other people about, particularly thinking about how other countries will view our strategy. When we decide to build new non-strategic nuclear weapons, why will that not appear to Russia and to other countries to be a ratification of their new strategy of escalation to de-escalate and an acceptance of limited nuclear war? And why is it that the administration decided to focus only or predominantly upon nuclear responses to a possible limited nuclear attack, rather than looking to the area of conventional response in which we have such an overwhelming superiority, remembering, of course, that in the old days when we thought the Russians had a conventional superiority, we were the ones who believed in first strike.
Let me say this. There is nothing in the Nuclear Posture Review that assumes an automatic nuclear response to any particular contingency. There is an element of strategic ambiguity there, which absolutely does not rule out our ability to respond in other ways as well, in ways of our choosing appropriately to the nature of the threat that we face. That could be response with conventional arms. It could be some other type of response. There is nothing in the NPR that says the United States, under this or that circumstance, will respond with nuclear weapons. There's no automaticity there. And so your point about other possible types of response is certainly valid, and it's not negated by anything in the nuclear posture review. Why is the focus of this review on nuclear weapons? Because it is a nuclear posture review. And the tasking was to review U.S. nuclear posture. So that, of course, is what the review did. In terms of the possible reactions of Russia, China, and other states, I have no doubt that anything the United States does or proposes to do would likely generate negative reactions on the part of those who would prefer the United States not to take any action at all to bolster or improve its nuclear deterrent capabilities. So it's not surprising to read or hear statements from Russian officials or Chinese officials or North Korean officials who are critical of the nuclear posture review and suggesting that the nuclear posture review does precisely the opposite of what it is intended to do. But I think the document itself has to be taken as a whole. And I think the context that is provided within the review itself, in terms of our assessment of the overall nuclear security environment, provides a realistic framework and rationale for understanding why we have come to the conclusions and recommendations we have come to. Now, look, I realize certainly reasonable people can have reasonable disagreements over this or that specific recommendation or the rationale behind it. That's what makes debate over this issue so robust. But nevertheless, I would encourage everyone, if you haven't read the full document, I'd encourage you to do that. Take a look at how the security environment is described and assess the conclusions and recommendations of the NPR in the context of our assessment. See whether or not it holds together and makes sense as you do that. I think it is a logical approach. I think it is a rational approach. And I think it's an approach that is, in fact, tailored to the kinds of 21st century threats we currently confront and are likely to confront in the future. So regardless of what some opponents might suggest, I think we've kind of hit it right in this particular review. I think it's balanced. I think it's consistent with what U.S. nuclear policy has been by and large for decades. And I think it's appropriately tailored to the different threats that we face today. Sure, Bob.
Dave, thanks so much for joining us at Brookings today and making the case for the Trump NPR. To achieve its ambitious objectives, modernization of the triad, the DOE nuclear complex, command and control system, the supplements you mentioned and so forth, these are expensive. There's a high price tag associated with them. You're going to need strong bipartisan support in the U.S. Congress. Presumably, you and other senior officials have engaged in consultations with members of Congress to make the case for the NPR and to get their support. how have those consultations gone? Are you confident that you're going to have the necessary domestic consensus for this ambitious program? And what are the particular challenges? What are the two or three challenges, you know, when you think of the talking points you're going to use in the Congress, what are the challenges you need to confront?
Very, very good question. And I would say so far, our discussions with others, with folks on the Hill and elsewhere, Democrats, Republicans, I would generally characterize them as overwhelmingly positive. Obviously, not everybody supports everything that we have proposed here in the Nuclear Posture Review. There are some that believe we go too far. There are others who believe we don't go far enough, which, again, just goes to show you in Washington, you can't please everyone, you know, all of the time. But I think, by and large, I have been quite pleased by what I have seen as generally bipartisan support for what we have done and what we are attempting to do with this particular NPR. Again, it's not, you know, universal, but it's quite substantial, I would argue. The biggest challenges, I think, are severalfold. Number one, explaining the rationale behind what it is we're proposing in a way that is understandable. This is, of course, and everyone here in this room knows it, this is a very esoteric issue. But it's an issue because of that. It's also an issue that occasionally lends itself to mischaracterization or misinterpretation. Explaining what we are proposing to do and why we are proposing to do it in a way that makes sense to multiple audiences, I think is a challenge, but is critically important to do if we are going to not only generate but maintain a level of bipartisan support that is needed to actually carry out the recommendations that we have proposed here. The other challenge, of course, you alluded to it in your question, is the issue of funding. No question that what we are talking about carries a substantial price tag. Just the very modernization of our existing triad is not an inexpensive undertaking. Relatively speaking to other things that we spend defense dollars on, it's a relatively minor fraction overall of the defense budget, maybe some 3-4%, which historically is rather low if you look at past periods of modernization and recapitalization of the triad. So, from my perspective, it's not so much a question of affordability. We can afford to do what we need to do when we're talking about such weighty issues as preventing nuclear war. Secretary Mattis likes to say, we can afford survival. And he's absolutely right. We can afford to do that. We simply need to be able to, number one, understand that doing so will require time. This is not something that will be done overnight, and it will require a commitment of resources that must be sustained over a period of time to get us to the point where we've actually achieved the objectives we've set forth. That in itself is a reasonably heavy lift. I would argue that as difficult as it was for us to spend the last year sort of constructing the NPR in a way that is reflective of the current security environment, that was probably the easy part. Now that we've done it, that easy part is over. The hard part will be trying to ensure that the recommendations are sustainable and actually carried out in order to accomplish the objectives that we've set forth from a policy prescription. So The challenge is just beginning. And by the way, this is a challenge that will go last well beyond this administration into the next administration. This is not something that can be done overnight or with a flick of a switch. So
I'll now ask the panel to join me on stage. Well, we're not going to take any break. We'll just go straight into that. But please join me as well in thanking Secretary Trachtenberg.
Well, thank you, everybody, for staying on with us, and our thanks to Secretary Trachtenberg. I'd like to very briefly now introduce the distinguished panel we have up here. We'll go straight into a discussion. We don't have a lot of time. We'll be here until 12. We'll have the last half hour or so for your questions. So let me very briefly introduce folks, then we'll go down the line with some questions tailored to each, have another round of discussion here, and then go to you. Just to my left is Madeleine Creedon. She was, and in this case, the word principal deputy, I think, does apply, principal deputy administrator of the Department of Energy's main arm that works on the nuclear warheads of our arsenal, the National Nuclear Security Administration. And so a lot of the issues concerning warhead modernization or the potential need to beef up the warhead complex in case we need to modernize and expand in the future, which the NPR addresses, will be questions that I will want to pose to Secretary Creedon. She also has considerable experience at the Department of Defense, where she was an assistant secretary, and also on Capitol Hill. In fact, that's one of the distinguishing characteristics of almost everybody up here today, is Capitol Hill experience as well, which is important for the reason Bob Einhorn got at a minute ago as we think about resources. Just to Madeline's left is Dr. Jim Miller, who was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy in the Obama administration. Prior to that, he was Principal Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under Michel Flournoy in the first term when he helped write the Nuclear Posture Review of 2010 that we've heard referenced several times. That was the previous NPR. And my opening question for Jim and for the panel in general is going to be, in fact, how much continuity is there from the 2010 NPR and how much change? And we'll get to that in just a moment. One more point on Jim. If you read his bio, you'll also notice, just as General Marty Dempsey did in the farewell speech he gave for Jim, that Jim was an excellent tennis player at Stanford. And I can attest to that. If you see the scar on my face, this is, well, only with slight exaggeration, Jim running me into the wall of the indoor facility with his slice second serve to the ad court. But that's just a personal note that I appreciate the indulgence. Just to Jim's left is Bob Einhorn, who had a distinguished career in government, but has come in and out of think tanks and done a lot of academic writing throughout his career as well. He's currently here with me at Brookings as another senior fellow in the foreign policy program, just as I am. Bob was Hillary Clinton's main advisor on non-proliferation strategy and worked very hard on issues like North Korea and Iran, as well as arms control treaties more generally in the Obama administration, had been at CSIS, had been in the Clinton administration, a great distinguished career, I think began at the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency back in the 1980s and has done many things since. And finally, James Acton, a physicist by training, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment, holds the Jessica Matthews Chair there, and has done a lot of the most rigorous technical writing on arms control, including on broad subjects such as the potential long-term hope for complete nuclear disarmament, but also questions of how do we build a stabilizing, safe, and secure deterrent in the meantime. So thrilled to have them all here. And Dr. Miller, if I could begin with you, please. I would be really fascinated to hear your comparison of the 2010 NPR to this one. Just how much change, how much continuity?
Thank you, Michael, and thanks for your very kind introduction and exaggeration of my tennis capabilities. Michael is actually a terrifically talented player, as well as an intellect. So, three quick points on the 2018 Nuclear Posture Review relative to the 2010 review. First is that there is a very strong thread of continuity, both with respect to the policy and with respect to the programs of the reviews. At the policy level, this NPR reiterates what the 2010 Nuclear Posture Review had to say about the U.S. Policy toward the employment of nuclear weapons, and that is that the nuclear weapons would be used only under extreme circumstances that threaten U.S. vital interests or the vital interests of our allies and partners. This Nuclear Posture Review reiterates the so-called negative security assurance, which says that the United States will not use or threaten to use nuclear weapons against non-nuclear weapon states that are compliant with their non-proliferation treaty obligations. And finally, this review, like the past review, rejects no first use or so-called sole purpose for nuclear weapons, but makes clear, in my view, that the fundamental role of nuclear weapons is to deter nuclear weapons use. At the policy level, a lot of consistency, and similarly, the support of arms control, including New START, and a desire to return the Russians to compliance with the INF Treaty, support of non-proliferation as well. And finally, a reiteration that the United States will abide by the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty and not seek nuclear testing, although this administration says it will not pursue ratification of that treaty. So from a policy perspective, a tremendous amount of continuity. And then on the programmatic side, similarly, focus on sustaining and now modernizing the triad, ICBMs, SLBMs, heavy bombers, and the related weapons. Real priority on investing in survivable nuclear command and control, which is also critically important for nuclear stability. And this is very much in Madeline's area of expertise, continuing to invest in the nuclear infrastructure that NNSA and the Department of Energy are responsible for. So in all of those areas, continuity. And I think that's fundamentally important. The place where we see the changes in the two weapon systems that David Trachtenberg mentioned, first a low-yield SLBM, and second, an over longer time frame, nuclear-tipped sea-launched cruise missile, which I hope will be deployed solely on submarines, not on surface ships, because of the greater stability and survivability. I want to defer on those issues, and we can come back to those. The third point I want to make is that there's an important difference, and there's no question that the 2010 nuclear posture review was President Obama's nuclear posture review. He'd given the Prague speech. Secretary Gates' forward to the 2010 nuclear posture review noted that this was an implementing mechanism for the Prague speech. There is a question, and we'll learn over time, I suppose, does this 2018 nuclear posture review signed by Secretary Mattis, does it represent the views of President Trump? President Trump's comments about having a bigger nuclear button, about bringing fire and fury to bear on North Korea in response for any aggression, cause one to wonder if that's the case. I hope that it is the case. Time will tell.
Thank you. One additional question. I think you laid that out very clearly and conceptually and in a good frame, but I want to understand one further point. To the extent the Trump administration or Secretary Mattis, the nominal author of this document, to the extent they do talk about the 2010 NPR, they do seem to want to emphasize continuity just as you have. In those places where they acknowledge discontinuity, they seem to attribute that less to a difference in worldview, Obama versus Trump, vision of nuclear disarmament versus, you know, big button. And they want to say more that it's that the world's changed since 2010, and we've seen in particular Russia's more aggressive behavior. Do you accept that interpretation that most of what's changed, to the extent there is change from 2010 to 2018, most of it is in the international security environment rather than in the occupant of the White House here in Washington?
Yeah, I can't speak to the involvement of the occupant of the White House in this review, as I noted. But I do agree that the world situation has changed substantially relative to 2010, when the Obama administration's nuclear posture review was done. Most notably, North Korea has advanced its missile and nuclear capabilities, and I believe that's an important reason to look at bolstering our extended deterrence posture, the so-called U.S. nuclear umbrella. And second, I also agree that Russia has continued to invest very substantially in tactical nuclear weapons and has displayed those nuclear weapons and its posture associated with them in multiple exercises, and its rhetoric has been such that thinking about how to bolster deterrence of Russian coercion or attack using nuclear weapons is appropriately an important focus of this review. And I'll just say, I'm sure we'll talk about later, but I'll say I think the steps that were taken in this review with the low-yield SLBM weapon and with the nuclear SLCM both make good sense given those changes.
So I do have one final follow-up, and then we'll move on to Bob Einhorn and then Madeline and James. You mentioned North Korea and Russia. You didn't mention China explicitly. Of course, you're being very concise and cogent, but I want to give you a chance to speak now about China. One striking dimension of the national security strategy and then the national defense strategy of the Trump administration, they tend to paint China and Russia with a similar brush. and the NPR does a little bit of that as well. Personally, I see China's nuclear behavior as much more restrained than Russia's, and so I'm a little bit concerned about the single brush. I wondered if you wanted to comment on that question as well.
Michael, I agree with your assessment, and my focus on North Korea and Russia was intentional. Yeah. Both of them have advanced their nuclear capabilities over the last 8 years, and in each in its own way is relying significantly on nuclear weapons, not only for deterrence, but for coercive capability. China has, as you know, has a no-first-use nuclear policy. I find that relatively credible, and I believe that their behavior and their modernization programs are consistent with what one would expect, given their no-first-use policy, for a country that is not just a to-be rising great power, but is a great power today, and establishing a diverse set of capabilities so that the People's Republic of China leadership can be confident that they have a secure second strike capability is a sensible set of steps from my perspective. It would be surprising to me if a great power took a different approach.
Thank you. Bob, let me turn to you. And again, we've been wrestling with the question of how much change, how much continuity. I know you've been thinking a lot about declaratory posture. How would you sum up the overall situation? Do you see more continuity than change from this nuclear posture to what had preceded it?
Thanks, Mike. The sum of both, continuity and change. The 2010 NPR, the 2018 NPR preserves the option for the United States to use nuclear weapons in response to both nuclear and non-nuclear aggression. As Jim just pointed out, both NPRs therefore reject the idea that deterrence of nuclear attack should be the sole purpose of U.S. nuclear weapons. So there's some continuity there. Also, and David Trachtenberg mentioned this, like the 2010 NPR, the Trump NPR says the United States will only consider the use of nuclear weapons in extreme circumstances when the vital interests of the United States, its allies and partners, are at stake. But there's an important difference here, at least in my view. The 2018 NPR defines extreme circumstances more broadly to include non-nuclear strategic attacks against U.S. allies, United States, and U.S. Partners. Now, the Trump NPR doesn't really define non-nuclear strategic attack. It doesn't explain what would make a nuclear attack strategic. Instead, it provides some examples. Non-nuclear attacks against civilian population centers and critical civilian infrastructure, against early warning, command and control, attack assessment capabilities. Now, previously, before the current NPR, the U.S. Maintained the option to use nuclear weapons in response to massive conventional aggression to stave off a major strategic defeat. You know, for example, the Warsaw Pact overrunning Western Europe, China conquering Taiwan, North Korea crossing the DMZ and occupying Seoul. The U.S. also preserved the option to use nuclear weapons in response to a non-nuclear WMD attack, equivalent to the use of nuclear weapons in lethality, such as a truly mass casualty biological weapons attack. These circumstances, in my view, set a very high bar for the U.S. initiation of the use of nuclear weapons. The examples that are provided in the Trump NPR, I think, lowers the bar. The use of nuclear weapons, in my view, would hardly be the most effective, proportionate, or credible way to respond to, for example, conventional bombing of population centers, conventional or cyber attack against critical infrastructure such as the electrical grid, or kinetic or cyber attack against warning or C-cubed assets. In my view, a better way to protect those potential targets is to make them more resilient, redundant, or defensible, and to threaten to retaliate with more credible but still highly potent non-nuclear means. The Trump administration may believe that declaring a readiness to use nuclear weapons in a wider range of circumstances will enhance deterrence. But I think such a declaratory policy has some significant downsides. If an adversary believes that the United States will use nuclear weapons early in a conflict, it may calculate that it's better off using nuclear weapons first. And concerns that the administration may be increasing the role of nuclear weapons if this perception were to become widespread in the American public, it could undermine the domestic consensus that is required to pursue the recapitalization of the U.S. Deterrent. The Trump administration may have been motivated, at least to some extent, by a political impulse to adopt a more robust approach to deterrence than its predecessors. But the 2018 NPR declaratory policy may raise some serious questions about the administration's nuclear intentions and might even do so without significantly increasing deterrence.
Bob, thank you. Just one follow-up for you. Do you have a sense there were certain scenarios the administration may have had in mind of this sort of non-nuclear strategic variety that they were really concerned about, that we had somehow underappreciated the severity? For example, high-altitude nuclear burst. I guess that would be a nuclear attack. But the equivalent in a cyber realm, for example, that brought down much of our national electricity grid and sort of put us on our heels as a nation for a year or what have you as we tried to rebuild the electricity infrastructure. Do you think it was specific scenarios like that, or was it a broader sense of just wanting to, you know, leave a sharper contrast with predecessors?
I'm not sure of that, and I think the administration will be under pressure in the weeks and months to come to begin to articulate what kinds of scenarios they would consider to be the kind of non-nuclear strategic attack that could warrant, you know, our consideration of nuclear use. I think some of the scenarios you mentioned are in their minds, but clearly the administration is going to be reluctant to be drawn out into specifics. I think it believes that ambiguity enhances deterrence, but I think ambiguity can be confusing. And it could lead some U.S. adversaries to jump to the wrong conclusion that the U.S. really is prepared to initiate nuclear war early in a conventional conflict. I think this is going to be, it may be difficult to sell current declaratory policy. I think, you know, fortunately for the administration, issues like the price tag of modernization and the supplements, the nuclear SLICM, the low-yield SLBM, those are easier to grasp onto in the public debate. Declaratory policy tends to be more abstract, more complicated. So maybe the administration may avoid some very searching questions. But I think, in the kind of the strategic community, I think some of these questions about declaratory policy will become very prominent.
Thank you. So, Madeline, if I could go to you, please. I would love to just first get your thoughts on explaining to us a little bit about what might be up with these new nuclear warhead concepts and to the extent you want to talk about your understanding of those. So, Secretary Trachtenberg said that the SLBM, the submarine launched variant, would be a minor modification to existing warhead type. I guess we can all guess what that might mean, and maybe you're not comfortable in an open forum speculating yourself, but if you can give us any insight into how you can have a much lower yield warhead that's only a modest or minor modification. And then secondly, for this would be a cruise missile warhead, what kind of time frame do you sense might be required to get to a point where that would be feasible?
Thanks, Michael. I want to actually start with another little twist.
Please.
in really a bit of the emphasis on this, and And that's really the lack of emphasis on nonproliferation, threat reduction that was in the 2010 NPR. So in terms of tone, although as both Jim and Bob have said, a lot of the policies are relatively consistent, I think this lack of emphasis on threat reduction and nonproliferation is telling. And the reason I say that is even though there is good language with respect to staying in New START, and both Russia and the U.S. have come into compliance now with New START, what's missing is really any commitment to the five-year extension, which is in New START. So, I mean, I understand the reticence to have any further discussions with Russia on new treaties. Russia's made it very clear that they're not interested in that. But even the omission of the five-year extension, I think, is telling. Now, the reason I put all that there is because I think it does have some influence on the language that deals with the nuclear weapons infrastructure at NNSA, because I think that is much more subtle in this NPR. But I think in many respects, it is much different from the previous NPR. So we all know that the infrastructure at NNSA, large parts of it, it's very old, it's very outdated, it needs to be replaced. And it's been a long process to get, and difficult, and expensive, to get some of that infrastructure going in terms of the replacement. What NNSA has been doing, and this is more to your point, is that it has been doing the life extensions on the existing warheads. Okay, so the plan, as I understand it from the NPR, is to take some number of the warhead for the D5, the ballistic missile, currently on the Columbia-class submarines. So this W76 is the one that's almost finished with the life extension. This was the first big life extension. And my understanding is that they will do something to it. I actually don't know exactly what they're going to do to modify it so that it's not the single high yield, and that it will have, I think, based on the reading of this, is that it will have a single low yield. Now, what that actually is, isn't terribly clear, but based on some of the reading, it's probably not a new warhead, but it is a new military purpose. Okay, so there's a, you know, you've got that debate. The second piece is the supplement for the sea launch cruise missile. So right now, the Air Force and the NNSA are developing an air launch cruise missile, and have decided that the warhead on that air-launched cruise missile will be the modified W-80, which is what's currently on the air-launched cruise missile, and in fact was on the old TLAM-N, the old nuclear Tomahawk. So my guess would be that if this sea-launch cruise missile goes forward, that the warhead on that, just like in the past, would probably be the modified W-80, which, once it's gone through life extension, will be the W-80-4. The first production unit for that 80-4 is until 2024. So all of this is very much out there in terms of timing. And that first set of 80-4s is really going to be for the air-launch cruise missile. So, again, if that's the way they go, that's not a new warhead, but in fact, sort of a return to an old capability.
So one more question for you before I go to James, who I hope may address this question as well. With your physicist background and your unclassified, like me, unclassified background and approach to these questions, you may be more willing to or able to speculate about how you make an SLBM warhead with a much lower yield without testing and without much work. But in any event, Madeline, thank you very much. I wanted to ask you about the fairly ambitious plans to modernize the Department of Energy NNSA infrastructure that we see in this NPR. And it seems to me, as you point out, you were part of an administration that worked very hard, just as its two predecessors had, to sustain the U.S. nuclear arsenal without nuclear testing. The last time we tested was 1992. And that was a concept that was well accepted. We've been spending close to $10 billion a year on science-based stockpile stewardship and also refurbishment. We've done a lot of hard work. We continue to have major weapons labs devoted to this. You oversaw a lot of that work. All of that was ongoing and didn't necessarily need a big injection of additional funding. But now we see in this 2018 NPR a commitment to build up an infrastructure that could produce up to 80 new warheads a year if necessary. And that strikes me as worth really focusing on as a separate issue from all the things that you were so rigorously and attentively focused to in the past. Do you see all that ambitious planning and spending as necessary, or would you perhaps either delay that or scale it back or not do any of it altogether?
So I think this is exactly what you just described, is exactly what I think is a very subtle change in this NPR from the last NPR. There's a much more aggressive approach to the NSA infrastructure. And the reason, the rationale for this more aggressive approach isn't just to maintain the capability to maintain our stockpile through stockpiled stewardship, but there is a subtle shift here. The NPR talks about increasing test readiness. The new NPR talks about PITs, but it uses somewhat new language. It talks about at least 80 PITs, and before the discussion was really 50 to 80. It talks about really pursuing the new statutorily mandated stockpile responsiveness program in a very aggressive way so that you're having the labs and the plants really do prototyping, almost doing design, maybe even doing a little metal bending. So you've got a lot of things that are being put in place that, and also some of the discussion with respect to hedging, that really looks like it's laying the foundation for a much larger arsenal down the road. I mean, that's how I would interpret this. So whether it becomes that or not, obviously, is something that only the future knows, but it certainly seems to be building a more capable infrastructure.
So larger arsenal and perhaps also new kinds of warheads someday with this hedged language on testing. Mm-hmm. We're not going to do it now, but maybe someday we might reserve the right to return.
Yes.
James, I know that among the panel, we just heard some concerns from Madeline Creedon and from Bob and Jim, but you may be the sharpest critic of any of us, or at least I'll invite you to be that if you wish. So let me just address to you the very simple question of, you know, what do you find most concerning about the NPR, as well as anything you want to say that you applaud or support?
Let me first weigh into this debate about continuity versus change. Mike, I think that government reports are a bit like T-shirts. In the real world, there's only so many changes you can make, right? Any T-shirt has to have two holes for your arms to come out and one hole to put over your head. And in the same way, there are limits to how much you can change a government report. So obviously, there's elements of continuity with previous NPRs. But I think within the range of NPRs that one could imagine a government of the United States conceivably producing, this one is much more change than continuity. Let me identify four different areas. Firstly, is the changes in declaratory policy that Bob, I think, has very ably outlined. And let me emphasize just one thing here. The United States is now threatening to use nuclear weapons in response to attacks that would almost certainly kill not a single human being. I'm referring here to attacks against space-based elements of the US nuclear command and control system. Those attacks could be extremely consequential. I'm not playing down their significance. I think threatening to respond with nuclear weapons to those is dangerous and incredible. Secondly, this document does not make any attempt to reassure Russia about the survivability of its nuclear forces. For decades, the United States has been willing to say, whatever incredibly serious political disagreements we have with Russia, including at the moment its annexation of territory from two sovereign states, we accept that, you know, we are in a relationship of mutual deterrence with Russia, and we're not going to try to undermine Russia's nuclear arsenal. This document does not do that. Thirdly, for practical intents and purposes, this document takes arms control off the table. It pays lip service to arms control. It doesn't completely exclude the possibility of doing it, but it's lip service. There is no serious constructive arms control agenda laid out. And fourthly, there's this issue of new capabilities, which are quite rightly, the framers of this NPR, in my opinion, rightly have concerns about Russia and about Russian first use. The issue here, though, is I think our fundamental problem is not with Russia's willingness to use nuclear weapons first. We don't have a no first use declaratory policy. We reserve the right to use nuclear weapons first if we were losing a large-scale conventional war. The problem we have with Russia is its combination of conventional superiority around the Baltics coupled to threats of first use. It's those two things together. We're worried that Russia might overtake the Baltic states because NATO is conventionally weak there, and then use nuclear threats to try to deter NATO from taking back NATO's territory. I think we should worry about that. I think that's a real problem. But when you frame the problem in the way that I've just done, that the root cause of the problem is conventional weakness around the Baltics, for me, the best solution to that is let's become less conventionally weak around the Baltics. I don't mean we should put hundreds of thousands of troops into the Baltics and have a capability that could match Russia. But what the theory of conventional deterrence tells us is conventional deterrence fails when the other side believes it can execute a rapid and bloodless fait accompli. Right now, Russia is so conventionally superior around the Baltics, it could take those territory in a matter of just a few days with, you know, minimal number of casualties. That's a huge problem, in my opinion. Having enough conventional force around the Baltics that Russia would sustain a bloody nose if it tried to take over the Baltics, that it would take 2 weeks of effort and tens or hundreds of thousands of casualties rather than 2 days and hundreds of casualties, I think would enhance our deterrence posture around the Baltic much, much more than two different types of new nuclear warheads would. Now, I don't want to go on for too long. I think there are, you know, there are real additional dangers and costs associated with these new warheads. But the big idea I want to get across here is the problem with addressing these security problems in a nuclear posture review is you inevitably end up looking for nuclear solutions to that. To my mind, there is a real security threat from Russia out there, and I don't play that down in any way. But I do think that our fundamental response to that is much more effective in the non-nuclear domain than in the nuclear domain.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.